still calling. That little voice, too, faded, but this time it left him more uneasy than usual. A violent, exaggerated version of the incident at the zone boundary flashed through his mind. Suddenly he was back, this time standing among the probationers. A bearded man dressed as a Pictish shaman held out a pair of binoculars and nodded insistently. Jacob picked them up and looked where the man pointed. Its image warped by heat waves rising from the highway, a bus rolled to a stop just on the other side of a line of candy-striped poles that stretched to each horizon. Each pole seemed to reach all the way up to the sun. Then the image was gone. With practiced indifference, Jacob let go of the temptation to think about it and allowed his mind to go completely blank. Silence and darkness. He rested in a deep trance, relying on his own internal clock to signal when the time to emerge was near. He moved slowly among patterns that had no symbols and long familiar meanings that eluded description or remembrance, patiently looking for the key he knew was there and that he'd someday find. Time was now a thing like any other, lost in a deeper passage. The calm dark was pierced suddenly by a sharp pain driving past all of his mind's isolation. It took a moment, an eternity that must have been a hundredth of a second, to localize it. The pain was a bright blue light that seemed to stab at his hypnosis-sensitized eyes through closed lids. In another instant, before he could react, it was gone. Jacob struggled for a moment with his confusion. He tried to concentrate solely on rising to consciousness, while a stream of panicky questions popped like flashbulbs in his mind. What subconscious artifact had that blue light been? A corner of neurosis that defends itself so fiercely as to mean trouble? What hidden fear did I probe? As he emerged, hearing returned. There were footsteps ahead. He picked them out from the sounds of the wind and sea. But in his trance they seemed like the soft padding ostrich feet might make if clothed in moccasins. The deep trance finally broke, several seconds after the subjective burst of light. He opened his eyes. A tall alien stood in front of him, a few meters away. His immediate impression was of tallness, whiteness, and huge red eyes. For a moment the world seemed to tilt. Jacob's hands flew to the sides of the table, and his head sank as he steadied himself. He closed his eyes. Some trance, he thought. My head feels as if it's about to crash through the earth and come out the other side. He rubbed his eyes with one hand, then carefully looked up once again. The alien was still there. So it was real. It was humanoid, standing at least 2 meters tall. Most of its slender body was covered by a long, silvery robe. The hands, folded in front in the attitude of respectful waiting, were long, white, and glossy. A very large round head bowed forward on a slender neck. The lidless, red, columnar eyes and the lips of the alien's mouth were huge. They dominated the face, on which a few other small organs served purposes unknown to him. This species was new to Jacob. The eyes glowed with intelligence. Jacob cleared his throat. He still had to fight off waves of dizziness. "Excuse me. Since we haven't been introduced, I don't know how I'm to address you, but I assume you're here to see me?" The big white head nodded deeply in assent. "Are you with the group the Contan Fagin asked me to meet?" Again, the alien nodded. "I suppose that means yes," Jacob thought. I wonder if he can speak. What with any imaginable kind of mechanism lurking behind those huge lips? But why was this creature just standing there? Was there something in its attitude? Am I to assume that yours is a client species, and you are waiting for permission to speak? The lips separated slightly, and Jacob caught a glimpse of something bright and white. The alien nodded again. Well then, speak up, please. We humans are notoriously short on protocol. What's your name? The voice was surprisingly deep. It hissed out of a barely widened mouth with a pronounced lisp. I am Kulloth, thank you. I have been sent to make sure that you were not lost. If you will come with me, the others are waiting. Or if you prefer, you can continue to meditate until the appointed time. No, no, let's go, by all means. Jacob rose to his feet unsteadily. He closed his eyes for a moment to clear his mind of the last shreds of the trance. Sooner or later he would have to sort out what had happened while he'd been under, but that would have to wait. Lead on. Kulla turned and walked with a slow, fluid gait toward one of the side doorways to the center. Kulla was apparently a member of a client species, one whose period of indenture to its patron species was still active. Such a race rated low on the galactic pecking order. Jacob, mystified as he still was by the intricacies of galactic affairs, was glad that a lucky accident had won for humanity a better, if insecure, place on the hierarchy. Kulla led him upstairs to a large oaken door. He opened it without announcement and preceded Jacob into the meeting room. Jacob saw two human beings, and besides Kulla, two aliens, one short and furry, the other smaller still and lizard-like. They were seated on cushions between some large indoor shrubs and a picture window overlooking the bay. He tried to sort his impressions of the aliens before they noticed him, but had only a moment before someone spoke his name.
"Jacob, my friend, how kind it is for you to come and share with us your time."
It was Fagin's fluting voice. Jacob looked quickly about the room. "Fagin, where?"
"I am here."
He looked back at the group by the window. The humans and the furry E.T. were rising to their feet. The lizard alien remained on its cushion. Jacob adjusted his perspective, and suddenly one of the indoor shrubs was Fagin. The old Contan silver-tipped foliage tinkled softly, as if there were a breeze. Jacob smiled. Fagin presented a problem whenever they met. With humanoids, one looked for a face, or something that served the same purpose. Usually it took only a little time to find a place in an alien's strange features on which to focus. There was almost always a part of the anatomy that one learned to address as the seat of another awareness. Among humans, and very often among ETs, this focus was in the eyes. A Contan has no eyes. Jacob guessed that the bright silver objects that made the sound of tiny sleigh bells were Fagin's light receptors. If so, it still didn't help. One had to look at the whole of Fagin, not at some cusp of the ego. It made Jacob wonder which was the larger improbability, that he liked the alien despite this handicap, or that he still felt uneasy with him, despite years of friendship. Fagin's dark, leafy body approached from the window in a series of twists that brought successive root knots to the fore. Jacob gave him one medium formal bow and waited.
"Jacob Alvarez Demois, a human, all dolphin, all chimp, we welcome you. It pleases this poor being to sense you today once again."
Fagin spoke clearly, but with an uncontrolled sing-song quality, which made his accent sound like mixed Swedish and Cantonese. The Contan did much better speaking dolphin or trinary. "Fagin, a Contan, ob Linton, ob sequel, ul nish, Mikori Kipu. It pleases me to see you once again. Jacob bowed.
These venerable beings have come to exchange their wisdom with yours, friend Jacob,
Fagin said.
I hope you are prepared for formal introductions.
Jacob set his mind to concentrate on the convoluted species names of each alien, at least as much as on their appearance. Patronymics and multiple client names would tell a great deal about the status of each. He nodded for Fagin to proceed.
I will now formally introduce you to Bubba Cub, Abhil, Abkisa, Absoro, Abhul, Abhuber, Ulgello, Ulpring, of the Library Institute.
One of the ETs stepped forward. Jacob's initial gestalt was of a 4-foot gray teddy bear, but a wide snout and fringe of cilia around the eyes belied that impression. This was Bubba Cub, director of the branch library. The branch library at La Paz consumed almost all of the meager trade balance which Earth had accumulated since contact. Even so, much of the prodigious effort of adapting a tiny suburban branch to human reference was donated by the huge Galactic Institute of the Library as a charity to help the backward human race catch up with the rest of the galaxy. As head of the branch, Bubba Cub was one of the most important aliens on Earth. His species name also implied high status, higher even than Fagin's. The Ab, something to the fourth, meant that Bubba Cub's species had been nurtured into sentience by another, which had in turn been nurtured by another, and so forth, back to the mythical beginning at the time of the progenitors, and that four of these generations of parentals were still alive somewhere in the galaxy. To be derived from such a chain meant status in a diffuse galactic culture whose every spacefaring species, with the possible lone exception of humanity, was brought up out of semi-intelligent savagery by some previous space-traveling race. The Ull something squared said that the Pill race had in turn fostered two new cultures on their own. This, too, was status. The one thing that had prevented the complete snubbing of the orphan human race by the Galactics was the fortunate fact that man had himself fostered new intelligent races twice before the Vesarius had brought contact with the E.T. civilization home to Earth. The alien made a slight bow.
I am Bubba Cub.
The voice sounded artificial. It came from a disk that hung from the Pill's neck. A Vodor. The Pill race required artificial assistance to speak English, then. From the simplicity of the device, much smaller than those used by alien visitors whose native tongues were twitters and squeaks, Jacob guessed that Bubba Cub could actually pronounce human words, but in a frequency range beyond human hearing. He decided to assume that the being could hear him. I am Jacob. Welcome to Earth. He nodded. Bubba Cub's mouth snapped open and shut a few times silently.
Thank you,
the Vodor buzzed in clipped short words.
I am happy to be here.
And I to be of service as your host. Jacob bowed ever so slightly deeper than he had seen Bubba Cub do when he came forward. The alien seemed to be satisfied and stepped back. Fagin recommenced his introductions.
These worthy beings are of your race.
A twig and a bunch of petals gestured vaguely in the direction of the two human beings. A gray-haired gentleman, dressed in tweed, stood next to a tall brown woman in handsome middle age.
I will now introduce you,
Fagin continued,
in the informal manner preferred by humans. Jacob Demois, meet Dr. Duane Kepler of the Sundiver Expedition, and Dr. Mildred Martin of the Department of Parapsychology at the University of La Paz.
Kepler's face was dominated by a substantial handlebar mustache. He smiled, but Jacob was too amazed to reply to his pleasantries with more than a monosyllable. The Sundiver expedition. The research on Mercury and in the solar chromosphere had been a football in the Confederacy Assembly of late. The Adapt and Survive faction said that it made no sense to spend so much for knowledge that could be pulled out of the library when the same appropriation could employ several times as many unemployed scientists here on Earth with make-work projects. The self-sufficiency faction had so far had its way, though, in spite of abuse from the Danakonite press. But to Jacob, it was the idea of sending men and ships down into a star that sounded like insanity of the first degree. Kant Fagan was enthusiastic in his recommendations, Kepler said. The Sundiver leader smiled, but his eyes were reddened. They bore puffy outlines from some inner worry. He pressed Jacob's hand in both of his own and pumped quickly as he spoke. His voice was deep, but it did not hide a quaver.
We came to Earth only for a little while. It's an answered prayer that Fagan was able to persuade you to meet with us. We really hope you can join us on Mercury and give us the benefit of your experience in interspecies contact.
Jacob started. Oh, no, not this time you don't, you leafy monster. He wanted to turn and glare at Fagan, but even informal intrahuman propriety required that he face these people and make small talk. Mercury, indeed. Dr. Martine's face fell easily into a pleasant smile, but she looked a little bored as he shook her hand. Jacob wondered if he could ask what parapsychology had to do with solar physics without sounding as if he were interested, but Fagan beat him to it.
I intrude, as is generally considered acceptable in informal conversations among human beings when a pause has occurred. There remains one worthy being to introduce.
Oops, thought Jacob. I hope this E.T.'s not one of the hypersensitive ones. He turned to where the lizard-like extraterrestrial stood, to his right, next to a multicolored wall mosaic. It had risen from its cushion and now moved on six legs toward them. It was less than a meter in length and about 20 centimeters high. It walked right past him without a glance and proceeded to rub itself against Bubba Cub's leg.
Ahem, Fagan said. That is a pet. The worthy whom you are about to meet is the estimable client who brought you to this room.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jacob grinned, then forced a serious expression onto his face.
Jacob Demois, a human, all dolphin, all chimp, please meet Kulla, Apring, Abpil, Abkisa, Absorrow, Abhull, Abpuber, assistant to Bubba Cub of the libraries, and representative of the library with the Sundiver Project.
As Jacob had expected, the name had only patronymics. The Pring had no clients of their own. They were of the Puber Sorrow line, though. Some day they would have high status as members of that old and powerful lineage. He had noticed that Bubba Cub's species was also out of the Puber Sorrow, and wished he could recall if the Pila and Pring were patron and client. The alien stepped forward, but did not offer to shake hands. His hands were long and tentacular, with six fingers each at the ends of long, slender arms. They looked fragile. Kulla had a faint odor, a bit like the smell of new-mown hay, that was not at all unpleasant. The huge columnar eyes flashed as Kulla bowed for the formal introduction. The E.T.'s lips curled back to display a pair of white, gleaming, grinder-mashy things, one on top and one on the bottom. The partially prehensile lips brought the cleavers together with a white porcelain clack. That can't be a friendly gesture where he comes from, Jacob shuddered. The alien probably pulled his huge dentures out to imitate a human smile. The sight was disturbing, and at the same time intriguing. Jacob wondered what they were for. He also hoped that Kulla would keep his lips curled back in the future. Nodding slightly, he said, "I am Jacob."
"I am Kulla, sir," the alien replied. "Your earth is very pleasant."
The great red eyes were now dull. Kulla backed away. Bubba Cub led them back to the cushions by the window. The little pill sprawled into a prone position with his quadrilaterally symmetric hands dangling over the sides of the cushion. The pet followed and curled up next to him. Kepler leaned forward and spoke hesitantly.
"I'm sorry we dragged you away from your important work, Mr. Demwa. I know you're already heavily engaged. I only hope that we can persuade you that our own little problem is worth your time and worthy of your talents."
Dr. Kepler's hands were knotted together on his lap. Dr. Martine looked on Kepler's earnestness with an expression of mildly amused patience. There were nuances here that bothered Jacob. "Well, Dr. Kepler, Fagin must have told you that since my wife's death I've retired from the mystery business, and I'm pretty busy right now, probably too much so to get involved in a long journey off-planet." Kepler's face fell. His expression became so bleak, so suddenly, that Jacob was moved. "However, since Kant Fagin is a perceptive individual, I'll be happy to listen to anyone he refers to me, and decide on the merits of the case."
"Oh, you'll find this case interesting. I've been saying all along that we need fresh insight. And, of course, now that the trustees have agreed to let us bring in some consultants..."
"Now, Duane," Dr. Martine said, "you're not being fair. I came in as a consultant 6 months ago, and Kulla brought the services of the library even earlier. Now Bubba Cub has kindly agreed to increase the library's support for the project and come personally with us to Mercury. I think the trustees are being more than generous."
Jacob sighed. "I wish someone would explain what this is all about."
"Like you, Dr. Martine. Perhaps you can tell me what your job is on Mercury?"
He found it difficult to say the word, sundiver.
"I am a consultant, Mr. Demwa. I was hired to perform psychological and parapsychological tests on the crew and environment on Mercury."
"I assume they had to do with the problem Dr. Kepler mentioned?"
"Yes. It was thought at first that the phenomena were a hoax or some sort of mass hallucination. I've eliminated both of those possibilities. It's clear now that they're real and actually take place in the solar chromosphere. For the last months, I've been designing psi experiments to take down on solar dives. I've also been helping as a therapist for a number of Sundiver staff members. The pressures of conducting this kind of solar research have been telling on many of the men."
Martine sounded competent, but there was something about her attitude that put Jacob off. Flippancy, perhaps. Jacob wondered what else there was to her relationship with Kepler. Was she his personal therapist as well? "For that matter, am I here just to satisfy the whim of a sick, great man who must be kept going?" The idea wasn't very attractive, nor was the prospect of getting involved in politics. Bubba Cub, head of the entire branch library on Earth, why is he involved in an obscure Terran project? In some ways, the little pill was the most important E.T. on the planet, outside of the Timbrimi ambassador. His library institute, the biggest and most influential of the galactic organizations, made Fagin's Institute of Progress look like a drum and tambourine outfit. Did Martine say he's going to Mercury? Bubba Cub stared at the ceiling, apparently ignoring the conversation. His mouth worked, as though singing in some range inaudible to humans. Culla's bright eyes were on the little library chief. Perhaps he could hear the singing, or perhaps he too was bored by the conversation so far. Kepler, Martine, Bubba Cub, Culla. I never thought I'd be in a room in which Fagin was the least strange. The Contin rustled nearby. Fagin was obviously excited. Jacob wondered what could have happened in the Sundiver project to get him so fired up. Dr. Kepler, it just might be possible that I could spare the time to help you out. Maybe. Jacob shrugged. But first, it would be nice to find out what this is all about. Kepler brightened.
Oh, didn't I ever actually say it? Oh, my. I guess I just avoid thinking about it these days. Just skirt around the subject, so to speak.
He straightened and took a deep breath.
Mr. Demois, it appears that the sun is haunted.
Part 2. In prehistoric and early times, the Earth was visited by unknown beings from the cosmos. These unknown beings created human intelligence by a deliberate genetic mutation. The extraterrestrials ennobled hominids in their own image. That is why we resemble them, and not they, us. Eric von Däniken, Chariots of the Gods. The sublime mental activities such as religion, altruism, and morality all evolved and have a physical base. Edward O. Wilson, On Human Nature, Harvard University Press. Chapter 4. Virtual Image. The Bradbury was a new ship. It used a technology far ahead of its predecessors on the commercial line, taking off from sea level under its own power, instead of riding to the station at the top of one of the equatorial needles slung beneath a giant balloon. Bradbury was a huge sphere, titanically massive by earlier standards. This was Jacob's first trip aboard a ship powered by the billion-year-old science of the galactics. He watched from the first-class lounge as the Earth fell away, and Baja California became first a brown rib, separating two seas, then a mere finger along the coast of Mexico. The view was breathtaking, but a bit disappointing. The roar and acceleration of a jetliner, or the slow majesty of a cruise Zepp, had more romance, and the few times he had left Earth before, rising and returning by balloon, there has been the other ships to watch, bright and busy as they floated up to power station or back down the pressurized interior of one of the needles. Neither of the great needles had ever been boring. The thin ceram walls that held the 20-mile towers at sea-level pressures had been painted with gigantic murals, huge swooping birds, and pseudo-science fiction space battles copied from 20th-century magazines. It had never been claustrophobic. Still, Jacob was glad to be aboard the Bradbury. Someday he might visit the Chocolate Needle at the summit of Mount Kenya, for nostalgia's sake. But the other one, the one in Ecuador, Jacob hoped never to see the Vanilla Needle again. No matter that the Great Tower was only a stone's throw from Caracas, no matter that he would be given a hero's welcome if he ever came there, as the man who had saved the one engineering marvel on Earth to impress even the galactics. Saving the needle had cost Jacob Demois his wife, and a large portion of his mind. The price had been too high. Earth had gained a visible disk when Jacob went off to look for the ship's bar. Suddenly he was in the mood for company. He hadn't felt that way when he came aboard. He'd had a rough time making excuses to Gloria and the others at the center. Makakai had raised a fit. Also, many of the research materials on solar physics he'd ordered had not arrived and would have to be forwarded to Mercury. Finally, he'd let himself get into a stew, wondering how he'd been talked into coming along in the first place. Now he made his way along the main corridor at the ship's equator until he found the crowded, dimly lit saloon. Inside, he squeezed past clots of talking, drinking passengers to get to the bar. About 40 persons, many of them contract workers bound for skilled labor on Mercury, crowded into the saloon. More than a few, having drunk too much, spoke loudly to their neighbors, or simply stared. For some, departure from Earth came hard. A few extraterrestrials rested on cushions in the corner set aside for them. One, a Cynthian with shiny fur and thick sunglasses, sat across from Culla, whose great head nodded silently, while he sipped daintily with a straw between his huge lips from what appeared to be a bottle of vodka. Several humans stood near the aliens, typical of the xenophiles who hang on every word of an eavesdropped E.T. conversation, and who wait eagerly for chances to ask questions. Jacob considered edging through the crowd to get to the E.T. corner. The Cynthian might be someone he knew, but there were too many people at that end of the room. He chose instead to get a drink and see if anyone had started storytelling. Soon he was part of a group listening to a mining engineer tell an enjoyably exaggerated tale of blow-ins and rescues in the deep Hermesian mines. Though he had to strain to hear over the noise, Jacob still felt he could conveniently ignore the headache that was coming on, at least long enough to listen to the end of the story, when a finger jabbed in his ribs made him jump.
"Demois, it's you!"
Pierre Larocque cried.
"How fortunate! We shall travel together, and now I know that there will always be someone with whom I can exchange witticisms."
Larocque wore a loose, shiny robe. Blue purse smoke drifted into the air from the pipe he puffed with Ernest. Jacob tried to smile, but with someone behind him stepping on his heel, it came out more like gritting his teeth.
"Hello, Larocque. Why are you going to Mercury? Wouldn't your readers be more interested in stories about the Peruvian excavations, or—"
"Or similar dramatic evidence that our primitive ancestors were nurtured by ancient astronauts?"
Larocque interrupted.
"Yes, Demois. Such evidence shall soon be overwhelming that even the skins and skeptics who sit on the Confederacy Council will see the error of their ways."
"I see you wear the shirt yourself." Jacob pointed to Larocque's silvery tunic.
"I wear the robe of the Danican Society on my last day on Earth in honor of the older ones who gave us the power to go into space."
Larocque shifted pipe and drink into one hand, and with the other straightened the gold medallion and chain that hung from his neck. Jacob thought the effect was a bit theatrical for a grown man. The robe and jewelry seemed effeminate, in contrast to the Frenchman's gruff manner. He had to admit, though, that it went well with the outrageous, affected accent. "Oh, come on, Larocque," Jacob smiled. "Even you have to admit we got into space by ourselves, and we discovered the extraterrestrials, not they us."
"I admit nothing," Larocque answered hotly. "When we prove ourselves worthy of the patrons who gave us our intelligence in the dim past, when they acknowledge us, then we'll know how much they have covertly helped us all these years."
Jacob shrugged. There was nothing new in the skin-shirt controversy. One side insisted that man should be proud of his unique heritage as a self-evolved race, having won intelligence from nature herself on the savanna and shoreline of East Africa. The other side held that Homo sapiens, just as every other known race of Sophonts, was part of a chain of genetic and cultural uplifting that stretched back to the fabled early days of the galaxy, the time of the progenitors. Many, like Jacob, were studiously neutral in the conflict of views, but humanity and humanity's client races awaited the outcome with interest. Archaeology and paleontology had become the great new hobbies since contact. However, Larocque's arguments were so stale they could be used for croutons, and the headache was getting worse. "That's very interesting, Larocque," he said as he began to edge past. "Perhaps we can discuss it some other time." But Larocque wasn't finished yet.
"Space is filled with Neanderthaler sentiment, you know. The men on our ships would prefer to wear animal skins and grunt like apes. They resent the older ones, and they actively snub sensible people who practice humility."
Larocque made his point while jabbing in Jacob's direction with the stem of his pipe. Jacob backed away, trying to stay polite, but having difficulty. "Well, now I think that's going a little too far, Larocque. I mean, you're talking about astronauts. Emotional and political stability are prime criteria in their selection."
"Aha! What you do not know about the very things you just mentioned. You joke, no? I know a thing or two about emotional and political stability of astronauts. I'll tell you about it sometime," he continued. "Someday, the whole story will come out about the Confederacy's plan to isolate a large part of humanity away from the elder races and from their heritage in the stars. All the poor unreliables. But by then it will be too late to seal the leak."
Larocque puffed and exhaled a cloud of blue pursmoke in Jacob's direction. Jacob felt a wave of dizziness. "Yeah, Larocque, whatever you say. You've got to tell me about it sometime." He backed away. Larocque glowered on for a moment, then grinned and patted Jacob on the back as he edged his way to the door.
"Yes," he said. "I'll tell you all about it. But meanwhile, better you should lie down. You don't look so good at all. Bye-bye."
He slapped Jacob's back once more, then slipped back into the bar. Jacob walked to the nearest port and rested his head against the pane. It was cool, and it helped to ease the throbbing in his forehead. When he opened his eyes to look out, the Earth was not in sight, only a great field of stars shining, unblinking against blackness. The brighter ones were surrounded by diffraction rays, which he could lengthen or shorten by squinting. Except for the brightness, the effect was no different than looking at the stars on a night in the desert. They didn't twinkle, but they were the same stars. Jacob knew he should feel more. The stars, when viewed from space, should be more mysterious, more philosophical. One of the things he could remember best about his adolescence was the asolipsistic roar of starry nights. It was nothing like the oceanic feeling he now got through hypnosis. It had been like half-remembered dreams of another life. He found Dr. Kepler, Bubba Cub, and Fagin in the main lounge. Kepler invited him to join them. The group settled around a cluster of cushions near the viewports. Bubba Cub carried with him a cup of something that looked and, from a chance whiff, smelled noxious. Fagin ambled slowly, twisting on his root pods, carrying nothing. The row of ports that ran along the curved periphery of the ship was broken in the lounge by a large circular disc, like a giant round window that touched floor and ceiling. The flat side protruded into the room about a foot. Whatever lay within was hidden behind a tightly fixed panel.
"We are glad that you made it,"
Bubba Cub barked through his vodor. He had sprawled on one of the cushions, and after saying this, dipped his snout into the cup he carried, and ignored Jacob and the others. Jacob wondered if the pill was trying to be sociable, or if he came by his charm naturally. Jacob thought of Bubba Cub as he, because he had no idea at all about Bubba Cub's true gender. Though Bubba Cub wore no clothes other than the vodor and a small pouch, what Jacob could see of the alien's anatomy only confused matters. He had learned, for instance, that the pilla were oviparous and did not suckle their young. But a row of what appeared to be teats lay like shirt buttons from throat to crotch. He couldn't even guess at their purpose. The data net did not mention them. Jacob had ordered a more complete summary from the library. Fagin and Kepler were talking about the history of sunships. Fagin's voice was muffled because his upper foliage and blowhole brushed against the soundproofing panels on the ceiling. Jacob hoped that Kantin were not prone to claustrophobia. But then, what were talking vegetables afraid of anyway? Being nibbled on, he supposed. He wondered about the sexual mores of a race whose lovemaking required the intermediary of a sort of domesticated bumblebee.
"Then these magnificent improvisations," Fagin said, "without benefit of the slightest help from outside, enabled you to convey packages of instruments into the very photosphere. This is most impressive, and I wonder that in my years here, I never knew of this adventure of your period before contact."
Kepler beamed.
"You must understand that the bathysphere project was only the beginning, long before my time. When laser propulsion for pre-contact interstellar craft was developed, they were able to drop robot ships that could hover, and by the thermodynamics of using a high-temperature laser, they could dump excess heat and cool the probe's interior."
"Then you were only a short time away from sending men."
Kepler smiled ruefully.
"Well, perhaps. Plans were made. But sending living beings to the sun and back involved more than just heat and gravity. The worst obstacle was the turbulence. It would have been great to see if we could have solved the problem, though."
Kepler's eyes shone for a moment.
"There were plans.
But then the Vesarius found Timbrimi ships in Cygnus," Jacob said.
"Yes, so we'll never find out. The plans were drawn up when I was just a boy. Now they're hopelessly obsolete, and it's probably just as well. There would have been inescapable losses, even deaths, if we'd done it without stasis. Control of time flow is the key to Sundiver now, and I certainly wouldn't complain about the results."
The scientist's expression suddenly darkened.
"That is, until now."
Kepler fell silent and stared at the carpet. Jacob watched him for a moment, then covered his mouth and coughed. "While we're on the subject, I've noticed that there isn't any mention of sun ghosts on the data net, or even in a special request from the library, and I have a 1AB permit. I was wondering if you could spare some of your reports on the subject to study during the trip?" Kepler looked away from Jacob nervously.
"We weren't quite ready to let the data off Mercury yet, Mr. Demois. They're our political considerations to this discovery that, we'll delay your briefing until we get to the base. I'm sure that all of your questions will be answered there."
He looked so genuinely ashamed that Jacob decided to drop the matter for the moment. But this was not a good sign.
"I might take a liberty in adding one piece of information," Fagin said. "There has been another dive since our meeting, Jacob, and on that dive, we are told, only the first and more prosaic species of Solarian was observed, not the second variety, which has caused Dr. Kepler so much concern."
Jacob was still confused by the hurried explanations Kepler had given of the two types of sun creatures so far observed. "Now, I take it that type was your herbivore?"
"Not herbivore," Kepler interjected. "A magnetivore. It feeds on magnetic field energy. That type is actually becoming rather well understood, however."
"I interrupt. In the most unctuous wish that I be forgiven for the intrusion, I urge discretion. A stranger approaches."
Fagin's upper branches rustled against the ceiling. Jacob turned to look at the doorway, a bit shocked that anything would bring Fagin to interrupt another sentence. Dismally he realized that this was still another sign that he had stepped into a politically tense situation, and he still knew none of the rules. "I don't hear anything," he thought. Then Pierre Larocque stood at the door, a drink in his hand, and his always florid face further flushed. The man's initial smile broadened when he saw Fagin and Bubba Cub. He entered and gave Jacob a jovial slap on the back, insisting that he be introduced right away. Jacob internalized a shrug. He performed the introduction slowly. Larocque was impressed, and he bowed deeply to Bubba Cub.
"Ab Kisa, ab Sorrow, ab Hull, ab Puber. And two clients, what were they, Demois? Jello and something? I'm honored to meet a sofant of the Sorrow line in person. I have studied the language of your ancestors, whom we may some day show to be ours as well. The Sorrow tongue is so similar to Proto-Semitic and Proto-Bantu also."
Bubba Cub's cilia bristled above his eyes. The pill through his vodor began to make voice with a complicated, alliterative, incomprehensible speech. Then the alien's jaws made short, sharp snaps, and a high-pitched growling could be heard, half-amplified by the vodor. From behind Jacob, Fagin answered in a clicking and rumbling tongue. Bubba Cub turned to face him, black eyes hot, as he answered with a throaty growl, waving a stubby arm in a slash in Larocque's direction. The Kantan's trilling reply sent a chill down Jacob's back. Bubba Cub swiveled and stamped out of the room without a further word to the humans. For a dumbfounded instant, Larocque said nothing. Then he looked at Jacob plaintively.
"What is it I did, please?"
Jacob sighed. "Maybe he doesn't like being called a cousin of yours, Larocque." He turned to Kepler to change the subject. The scientist was staring at the door through which Bubba Cub left. "Dr. Kepler, if you haven't any specific data on board, perhaps you could lend me some basic solar physics texts and some background histories on Sundiver itself?"
"I'd be delighted to, Mr. Demois,"
Kepler nodded.
"I'll send them to you by dinner time."
His mind appeared to be elsewhere.
"I, too," Larocque cried. "I am an accredited journalist, and I demand the background upon your infamous endeavor, Mr. Director."
After a moment's startlement, Jacob shrugged. "Have to hand it to Larocque. Chutzpah can be easily mistaken for resiliency." Kepler smiled as if he had not heard.
"I beg your pardon?"
"The great conceit, this Sundiver project of yours, which takes money that could go to the deserts of Earth for reclamation or to a greater library for our world. The vanity of this project to study what our betters understood perfectly before we were apes. Now, see here, sir, the Confederacy has funded this research."
Kepler reddened.
"Research! Research it is! You research for that which is already in the libraries of the galaxy, and shame us all by making humans out to be fools!"
"Larocque," Jacob began, but the man wouldn't shut up.
"And what of your Confederacy? They stuff the elders into reservations like the old-time Indians of America. They keep access to the branch library out of the hands of the people. They allow continuation of this absurdity that all laugh at us for this claim of spontaneous intelligence.
Kepler backed away from Laroque's vehemence. The color drained out of his face, and he stammered.
I don't think.
Laroque, come on, cut it out. Jacob grabbed his shoulder and pulled him over to whisper urgently in his ear.
Come on, man, you don't want to shame us in front of the venerable Kantan Fagan, do you?
Laroque's eyes widened. Over Jacob's shoulder, Fagan's upper foliage rustled audibly in agitation. Finally, Laroque's gaze dropped. The second embarrassment must have been enough for him. He mumbled an apology to the alien, and with a parting glare at Kepler, took his leave. Thanks for the special effects, Fagan, Jacob said after Laroque was gone. He was answered by a whistle, short and low. Chapter 5 Refraction. At 40 million kilometers, the sun was a chained hell. It boiled in black space, no longer the brilliant dot that the children of Earth took for granted and easily, unconsciously avoided with their eyes. Across millions of miles, it pulled. Compulsively, one felt a need to look, but the need was dangerous. From the Bradbury, it had the apparent size of a nickel held a foot away from the eye. The specter was too bright to be endured undiminished. To catch a glimpse of this orb, as one sometimes did on Earth, would invite blindness. The captain ordered the ship's stasis screens polarized and the regular viewing ports sealed. The Lyot window was unshuttered in the lounge so that passengers could examine the life-giver without injury. Jacob paused in front of the round window in a late-night pilgrimage to the coffee machine, half awake from a fitful sleep in his tiny stateroom. For minutes he stared, blank-faced, still only half-conscious, until a lisping voice roused him.
"This is the way your sun looks from the aphelion of the orbit of Mercury, Jacob."
Culla sat at one of the card tables in the dimly lit lounge. Just behind the alien, above a row of vending machines, a wall clock read 0430 in glowing numbers. Jacob's sleepy voice was thick in his throat.
Are we that close already?
Culla nodded.
Yes.
The alien's lip grinders were tucked away, his big folded lips pursed and let out a whistle each time he tried to pronounce an English long S. In the dim light, his eyes reflected a red glow from the viewing window.
"We have only two more days until we arrive," the alien said.
His arms were crossed on the table in front of him, the loose folds of his silver gown covered half of the surface. Jacob, swaying slightly, turned to glance back at the port. The solar orb wavered before his eyes.
"Are you all right?"
the Pring asked anxiously. He started to rise.
No, please.
Jacob held up his hand.
I'm just groggy. Not enough sleep. Need coffee.
He shambled toward the vending machines, but halfway there he stopped, turned, and peered again at the image of the furnace sun.
It's red, he grunted in surprise.
Shall I tell you why? While you get your coffee?
Culla asked.
Yes, please.
Jacob turned back to the dark row of food and beverage dispensers looking for a coffee spout.
The Lyot window only allows in light in monochromatic form, Culla said. It is made of many round plates, some polarizers and some light retarders. They are rotated with respect to one another to finely tune which wavelength
is allowed through. It's a most delicate and ingenious device, although quite obsolete by galactic standards, like one of the Swiss watches some humans still wear in an age of electronics, when your people become adept with the library, such Rube Goldberth will be archaic.
Jacob bent forward to peer at the nearest machine. It looked like a coffee machine. There was a transparent panel door, and behind that a little platform with a metal grill drain at the bottom. Now, if he pushed the right button, a disposable cup should drop onto the platform, and then from some mechanical artery would pour a stream of the bitter black beverage he wanted. As Kulla's voice droned on in his ears, Jacob made polite sounds.
Uh-huh. Yes, I see.
At the far left, one of the buttons was lit with a green light. On impulse, he pressed it. He watched the machine blearily. Now. That was a buzz and a click. There's the cup. Now. What the hell? A large yellow and green pill fell into the cup. Jacob lifted the panel and took out the cup. A second later, a stream of hot liquid spilled through the empty space where the cup had been, disappearing in the drain below. Dubiously, he glowered down at the pill. Whatever it wasn't coffee. He rubbed his eyes with his left wrist, one at a time. Then he sent an accusing glance at the button he'd pressed. That button had a label, he now saw. It read, E.T. Nutrient Synthesis. Below the label, a computer card stuck out from a data slot. The words, Pring, Dietary Supplement, Coumarin Protein Complex, were printed along the protruding end. Jacob looked quickly at Kulla. The alien continued his explanation while he faced the Lyot window. Kulla waved one arm toward the sun's Dantean brilliance to emphasize a point.
This is now the red alpha line of hydrogen, he said. A very youthful spectral line, instead of being overwhelmed by huge amounts of random light from all levels of the sun, we can now look at only those regions where elemental hydrogen absorbs or emits more than normal.
Kulla pointed to the sun's mottled surface. It was covered with dark reddish speckles and feathery arches. Jacob had read about them. The feathery arches were filaments. Viewed against space at the solar limb, they were the prominences that had been seen since the first time a telescope was used during an eclipse. Kulla apparently was explaining the way these objects were viewed head-on. Jacob considered. Throughout the voyage from Earth, Kulla had refrained from eating his meals with the others. All he would do is sip an occasional vodka or beer with a straw. Although he had given no reasons, Jacob could only assume that the being had some cultural inhibition against eating in public. Come to think of it, he thought, with those mashies for teeth, it could get a little messy. Apparently I've barged in while he's having breakfast, and he's too polite to mention it. He glanced at the tablet, which still lay in the cup in his hand. He dropped the pill into his jacket pocket and crumpled the cup into a nearby trash bin. Now he could see the button, which was labeled Coffee Black. He smiled ruefully. Maybe it would be best to skip the coffee and not run the risk of offending Kulla. Although the E.T. had made no objections, he had kept his back turned while Jacob visited the food and beverage machines. Kulla looked up as Jacob approached. He opened his mouth slightly, and for an instant the human caught a glimpse of white porcelain.
"Are you less groggy now?"
the alien asked solicitously.
"Yes, thanks. Thanks also for the explanation. I always thought of the sun as a pretty smooth place, except for sunspots and prominences. But I guess it's actually pretty complicated."
Kulla nodded.
"Dr. Kepler is the expert.
You will get a better explanation from him when you go on a dive with us.
Jacob smiled politely. How carefully these galactic emissaries were trained. When Kala nodded, was the gesture personally meaningful, or was it something he had been taught to do at certain times and places around humans? Dive with us? He decided not to ask Kala to repeat the remark. Better not to press my luck, he thought. He started to yawn. Just in time, he remembered to stifle it behind his hand. No telling what a similar gesture would mean on the Pring home planet.
Well, Kala, I think I'm going to go back to my room and try for a little more sleep. Thanks for the talk.
You are most entirely welcome, Jacob. Good night.
He shuffled down the hall and barely made it to bed before he was fast asleep. Chapter 6 Retardation and Diffraction. A soft, pearly light suffused through the ports, illuminating the faces of those who watched Mercury glide beneath the descending ship. Almost everyone who did not have a duty to perform was in the lounge, held to the row of viewing windows by the planet's terrible beauty. Voices were hushed, and conversations settled into small groups gathered around each port. For the most part, the only sound was a faint crackling, which Jacob couldn't identify. The surface of the planet was gouged and scratched with craters and long rills. The shadows cast by the mountains of Mercury were vacuum-sharp in their blackness, set against bright silvers and browns. In many ways, the place resembled the Earth's moon. There were differences. In one area, a whole piece had been torn off in some ancient cataclysm. The scar made a deep series of grooves on the side that faced the sun. The Terminator ran starkly along the edge of the indention, a sharp borderline of day and night. Down there, in places where shadow did not fall, a rain of 7 different types of fire fell. Protons, X-rays, spun off from the planet's magnetosphere, and the simple blinding sunshine itself mixed with other deadly things to make the surface of Mercury as unlike the moon as any place could be. It seemed like a place where one could find ghosts, a purgatory. He remembered a line from an ancient pre-haiku Japanese poem that he had read only a month before. More sad thoughts crowd into my mind. When evening comes, for then appears your phantom shape, speaking as I have known you speak.